Last week I invited you all to shout out words that express why you come to a religious institution to find what you're looking for in a community. And for those of you who weren't here, here's what we shouted out. It was supposed to be a surprise. Still working on the technology. Look at what a beautiful expression of our collective Unitarian Universalist theology you all created. The words are different from those that Jack Mendelsohn used in the affirmation that Chris just read, but the pictures painted by both are very similar. So today, we're going to explore some of the stories that led to this understanding, this picture that these words and Reverend Mendelsohn's words paint. So let me start by telling you that our faith is the product of a consolidation between two faith traditions that were descended from Christianity. Both strands started in Europe, but developed separately in the US. And there are three basic themes that run through the Unitarian side of our history. And the first is freedom. And I want to offer you a few vignettes around that theme. First, the setup. Why freedom was such a big focus, especially for early Unitarians. And I'll start in Europe. And yes, this is going to be a little more of a lecture than you all are used to. That's why the pictures. In the year 325, the Roman Emperor Constantine found himself with a little problem. He couldn't get the people in all the lands he had conquered to unite under him. Poor man. He decided to use religion as a unifying force, and he called a council in Nicaea to define Christianity 300 years after the life of Jesus, and to create a creed so that the criteria against which people could be included or excluded could be established. The bishops attending the council established the divine nature of Jesus and his relationship with God the Father. Pretty good work. And they paved the way for this idea of the Trinity, God in three parts, Father, Son, and Spirit, which are all God and are not each other. And this three-in-one idea is the Trinity. This idea became the orthodoxy, the only doctrine. And that doctrine defined the church that became the state institution. And so any other belief became heresy. And heresy became a threat and thereby a reason for persecution. There are all kinds of heretics. Our Unitarian ancestors in Europe were anti-Trinitarian heretics, heretics who did not believe in the Trinity. So on August 13th, 1553, Michael Servetus was arrested as a heretic after attending church in Geneva, Switzerland, where John Calvin had been preaching. Servetus was burned at the stake 2 months later with his book tied to his body. The book was called On the Errors of the Trinity. This was a time of intense persecution for heretics, and anti-Trinitarians were very high on the list of threats to the state institution. On the other side of the coin was King Sigismund of Hungary. Just 15 years after Servetus was martyred, King John Sigismund, under the advisement of his Unitarian minister, Francis David, who is credited with this quote, perhaps incorrectly, we're not sure, but he's credited with this quote, we need not think alike to love alike. David advised King Sigismund to issue an edict of toleration in Hungary in the midst of the persecution around the rest of Europe. And King Sigismund agreed. The edict made it illegal to persecute heretics. Technically, only heretics who were Roman Catholics, Lutherans, Calvinists, and Unitarians. But Jews and Muslims were also generally tolerated, even though they didn't have legal protection. So freedom is an early theme in our history. It continues through this day, and today's Unitarian Universalists consider it a basic part of our identity. We mentioned it. Jack Mendelsohn mentioned it. Almost everyone who talks about Unitarianism mentions it, because we believe deeply in our individual freedom of belief for ourselves and for our neighbors. We value the freedom of our congregations to make their own decisions, and we fight for the freedoms of the marginalized in our society. Our other themes in Unitarianism are reason and tolerance, and I'm combining those two because the stories I want to offer you are intersectional. But first, another setup. So we're in the US now, early to mid-1700s. The New England Puritans had established congregational polity a century ago. This is a non-hierarchical structure that gave congregations autonomy but asked them to cooperate with each other. Congregational polity. This served to remove any requirement of consistency of doctrines and practices among congregations, right? And so when some of the ministers started to learn and open up to different ways of believing in our Unitarian tradition, which really almost didn't exist at this point yet, but the tradition did, the ministers were learning and thinking and going, oh, that doesn't make sense. I'm not going to do that anymore. Their congregations would often change with them because the strictures holding them, the hierarchical strictures holding them in place, were not there. And so there was controversy after controversy in the evolution of the congregational church. Each time, the more liberal-leaning ministers stretched their ways about thinking about God and Jesus. And so the Great Awakening happens in the US, a revival movement that's created by the more conservative ministers, that's characterized by this high emotion and this religious enthusiasm. The liberal ministers countered this movement by lifting up reason and tolerance as religious virtues, which put Unitarians on a path to use these values in their continuing faith discernment. One of the most famous ancestors of American Unitarianism is William Ellery Channing. He was the first minister to claim the label Unitarian, which in those days was really controversial. He delivered sermons in the 1820s and 30s in these really high-profile places, and these sermons defined what he was beginning to call Unitarian Christianity, saying the Trinity made no sense, and that the Trinity was a distraction from true worship of God, and that the Unitarian view was the most conducive to living a pious life, and that we are made in God's image, and that we find the divine in ourselves. And because Channing was so prone to using reason, his sermons started becoming these scholarly and rational explanations of Scripture, and other liberal ministers started to follow suit. There was some pushback to this trend, most famously by Ralph Waldo Emerson on our right there, on your left, and Theodore Parker on your right, and some of the other transcendentalists. These are folks who thought that scholarly explanations of Scripture were not the stuff of a real lived faith. Emerson, in fact, called Unitarianism corpse cold. And Parker turned the denomination on his ear when he delivered a sermon called The Transient and the Permanent in Christianity, where he dared to claim that Christianity was just one expression of eternal truth, and that same truth found expression in other religions. This is in 1841. Parker was viewed by Unitarian ministers as a heretic. Right? So, hey, we've become the establishment. He was viewed by Unitarian ministers as a heretic for this, and they started to distance themselves from him. And in the end, I mean, this is a long story that I don't have time for now, but in the end, he forced them to start asking themselves, are we Christian? And if so, what kind of Christian are we? And I can't talk about reason in Unitarianism without talking about the humanists. In the early to mid-1900s, Unitarianism was no longer exclusively Christian. And the humanist movement revived the importance of reason and intellect in shaping our beliefs. You see the pendulum swinging? Many UU congregations are still heavily influenced by this movement, which contributed so much to our faith. And then finally, you can't talk about history without the story of the Flaming Chalice. In 1941, the executive director of the then Unitarian Service Committee needed a symbol to use on his correspondence, something that looked official while still conveying the spirit of their work. Their work was that the service committee had just been founded to help Eastern Europeans escape Nazi persecution. So he commissioned Hans Deutsch, who drew something very like this, which became a seal for papers, but also a badge for agents moving refugees to freedom so that they could recognize the agents. For Deutsch, the chalice represented a cup that is used for giving a healing drink, and the flame represented helpfulness and sacrifice. I'm going to shift gears to the Universalist tradition, which is and was grounded in love and full of faith and hope, as we heard as we lit our chalice this morning. The symbol for this tradition was this off-center cross in a circle. The cross showed that it was a Christian faith, but it was placed out of the center to show room for other points of view. And the circle represents the universe. Two famous Universalists, some call them the Founding Fathers, John Murray on your left, Hosea Ballou on your right. John Murray's story is one of faith. He was a Methodist preacher in England who was influenced there by a Universalist named James Relly. And in 1770, he travels to the New World after a series of personal tragedies. His wife sickens and dies. His child dies. He's thrown in debtor's prison. He gets out. I don't remember if he escapes or is actually released. But he gets out, and he gets on a ship, and he travels here. And it's his ship comes aground right outside of New Jersey in Barnegat Bay. And in Barnegat Bay, New Jersey, a man named Thomas Potter had built a church, a Universalist church, and was waiting for itinerant preachers to come along, which is what you did when you were a Universalist in the late 1700s in the U.S., And so Murray comes aground, and he runs into Potter and this church, and Potter tries to convince Murray to preach, and Murray says, no, I'm done with this stuff. I'm having a really hard life, and I need to just chill. And he says, no, I'm not gonna preach, and Potter is persistent, and he says, please, just one Sunday come and preach in my church. And finally Murray says, you know what, if my ship is not pulled up off the ground that it's stuck on out in Barnegat Bay, I will come and preach. And that happened. That happened. They didn't get the ship out of Barnegat Bay on time, and so John Murray went and preached in Potter's church, and it was a life-changing experience for him to be in the pulpit and to be able to articulate his Universalist faith. So he does eventually sail on to New York, which is where his end goal was, and he starts a long career as a Universalist minister there. And Hosea Ballou exemplified hope. He heard the message of universal salvation preached when he was a teenager, and he started preaching that message when he was 20. He wrote a book called A Treatise on Atonement in 1805, and in that book he argued that God was more like a loving parent than a vengeful scorekeeper, and that Jesus came to reveal divine love, not to provide atonement. He believed that we humans needed to be reconciled with God rather than the other way around, and that once we figured this out, being and doing good would make us so happy we wouldn't want to be any other way. It's It's quite a hopeful way to be. And then love. Love, the underlying theme of universalism, a loving God, and the love we show one another in our lives. Love is how we know that there is no eternal punishment after death. It's what we evoke when we live the way Hosea Ballou thought we maybe could. And it's the thing that brings us to seeking justice. And so, the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America consolidated in 1961. And since then, there have been all these variations on these themes. Love has remained as an underlying value, guiding how we try to live and learn together, how we learn to be our best selves in community, why we work for justice in the world. Freedom and reason and tolerance are reflected in our seven principles, in how we govern ourselves, in our expectations of our clergy, and in how we welcome people. And so I'm going to shift again into some places in which we have failed to live up to those values. For example, in all the pictures I've showed you, what kinds of faces aren't we seeing? That's what we are seeing, right? White males. White males. We're not seeing women. While Unitarians and Universalists have been a little more progressive than their surrounding culture, we have not made room for women in the same places as the men whose stories we have heard. In 1870, there were only 5 women Unitarian or Universalist clergy compared to 600 men. And in 1890, 20 years later, there were about 70 ordained women clergy across the 2 denominations, but those women were called to smaller and less stable congregations than their male counterparts, and many of them were considered to be an embarrassment by their denomination. The Iowa Sisterhood was a group of women who served congregations in the West in the late 1800s and early 1900s. These placements out on the frontier, right, in Michigan and Ohio and Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska. This is the frontier. People don't want to go there. So they were isolated. So Mary Safford on your right and Eleanor Gordon, sorry, your left, Eleanor on your right, Ida Halton, Carolyn Bartlett Crane, they were 4 of these women. There were about 20 of them. Their stories are different, but they hold similarities, like being held back from advanced formal education, finding support from some of the more liberal male ministers, and seeking their own pastorates, wanting to be ministers in congregations on their own. What these women did was bring a humanity to Unitarian ministry that was missing in many of these male-ministered congregations. And so they helped Unitarianism become more pastoral, more social, more community-oriented, and less academic. And the further away from Boston, which was the center of Unitarianism, the further away from Boston you got, the less academic you got anyway. And so Boston clergy, the center of Unitarianism, institutionally refused to see the good in this, and they intentionally replaced these women eventually with male ministers. We're also not seeing any people of color. There are quite a few stories of African American men in particular seeking education or credentialing in Unitarian ministry and being either ignored or actively shut down by our denomination. Egbert Ethelred Brown, on your left, discovered Unitarianism in 1888 and decided to become a minister in 1907. He was in Jamaica at the time, and he appealed to the American Unitarian Association for help getting to the U.S. so he could attend seminary. They encouraged him, but they didn't do anything to help him help him obtain permission to move to the U.S., so it took him a few years of persistence, but he was able to enroll in 1910, and he was ordained in 1912, and he went back to Jamaica to try to plant a Unitarian church there. He had to return to the U.S. 8 years later because that church was not very successful and did not receive support from the denomination. And he founded the Harlem Community Church in New York. The AUA, the American Unitarian Association, once he got to New York, they would support him for a while, and then he'd hear nothing for a while, and then they'd support him for a while, and then he'd hear nothing. And so his position and his finance were unstable for his entire career. And this was during a time of good denominational support of his white colleagues. Louis McGee, on your right, was ordained into the AME Church in 1917. And in 1920, he saw a Unitarian magazine, and he went, whoa, this is cool, and he decided to convert. Although he continued to serve as an AME minister for years, he started communication with the American Unitarian Association at that point and was not encouraged in any way, shape, or form into the ministry. And despite that, he enrolled at Meadville Theological School in 1946, 26 years after he converted. And he was ordained as a Unitarian minister in 48 and was called to serve the Free Religious Fellowship in Chicago. And in 1948, he was the first black man to be called into a Unitarian church. He served there for 5 years, and then he moved on to become the administrative assistant for the American Humanist Association. And then he tried to take an opportunity for settlement with the Unitarian Church in Flint, Michigan, but he didn't receive enough votes to be called. In 1958, he became an associate minister at a church in Los Angeles, while another black minister, the second, was called in Rhode Island. And he served there for a few more years and then served a few short-term calls, and then he retired. And then finally, it was the empowerment controversy. In 1967, just 2 years after 100 UU ministers had answered Martin Luther King Jr.'s call to Selma, the Black UU Caucus was formed by black folks who had been invited to an emergency conference that had been called in response to the race-based violence and chaos happening throughout the country. They did not find support in that conference, and they withdrew and formed the Black UU Caucus. And they presented a list of demands to that conference, including the creation and funding of a Black Affairs Council. And so the leaders of the Black Affairs Council were elected at a national conference of Black UUs the next year, and then after that conference, a second group called the Black and White Alternative formed. So there were two groups. One that came out of a need that black folks explicitly saw, and one that was an alternative created by a group of black and white folks. The 1968 General Assembly voted to fund both groups, but then it turned out the money wasn't there. And so at the 1969 General Assembly, the Black Affairs Council wanted to talk about that very early on in the agenda, and they made a demand to say, let's talk about this early in the agenda instead of on Sunday when you have us, you know, at the end of the week when you have us scheduled. The GA delegates debated on this very heatedly, not very kindly, and then refused to accept a change in agenda. The Black Affairs Council members and their white supporters walked out of the session and reconvened across the street at the Arlington Street Church where Jack Mendelson served. It looked like this could actually lead to a denominational split. This was really intense. Eventually, through the course of the day, the Black Affairs Council members were convinced to return. And the delegates at the GA narrowly, very narrowly, voted to fund them and not the black and white alternative group. The funding had to be lower than originally promised because of this lack of money. And the Black Affairs Council eventually disaffiliated itself from the UUA and launched its own funding campaign, and a legacy of distrust still lingers from this painful episode. And so now here we are, launching into another attempt at doing right by those on our margins, our women and our trans people, are gay and lesbian and bisexual and queer people, are people of color. Jack Mendelsohn, who happens, as I mentioned, to be one of the white allies to the Black Affairs Council who walked out of that 1969 General Assembly in solidarity, Jack Mendelsohn said, "Our faith is personal. It's reasonable. It's free. It's developing. It's supportive. It's responsible. It's diverse." You all said our faith is all of these things. And Reverend Mendelsohn wrote about all of these attributes, and I think of all of these attributes as both our history and our hope. Our history, however, can only be our hope if we know it and learn from it. May it be so, and may we be so.